Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, 100 years in the fight for women's equality in the United States. 2020 marked a century since American women won the right to vote. In a new book, historian Elizabeth Griffith traces what happened next, asking how women exercised their political power and pushed for change. It's a story with victories and defeats, and one that reveals the tensions over creating an inclusive path to fair treatment across race and class. Her new book is Formidable, American Women and the Fight for Equality, 1920 to 2020. Betsy, this book covers 100 years of women's growth, progress, setbacks, with so many people whose names we recognize and many whose names we don't. Why did you decide to bite off such a big portion of women's history?
Diane, Formidable began with the anticipation of the centennial of the 19th Amendment in August 2020. There was so much intended hoopla. And I thought, but we already know what happened with suffrage and what didn't happen with suffrage, who was covered, who was left out, how it was an incomplete victory. But I want to know more. I want to know what women did when they got the vote. Did they vote? Did they use the vote? Did they lobby? If white women were included, were they active? And if black women who were covered by the amendment were not allowed to vote because of discriminatory laws, what did they do? I knew it was a complicated story because, as you know, I've been teaching and writing about women's history for a long time. And I kept learning new things. And I thought, if somebody who's pretty deeply rooted in women's history doesn't know the names of all these change agents and heroines and how diverse the cast was, then there's a story there to tell. And these women, as you know, were formidable and fabulous.
What was the biggest surprise in this history for you?
I'm still surprised by how long it takes, how deep the opposition is, how rooted patriarchy is, for which I blame both sexism and racism. And, you know, still so apparent today that there are white men, specifically in power, who seem to have no empathy, no understanding for people who are unlike them. And I don't think you can really create community or advanced democracy if you are not open-minded about all the people who participate in that democracy or would like to participate in that democracy.
But is it possible to generalize about what's been gained in the 100 years and what remains?
Well, yes. clearly, there have been enormous advances, and I do not wish to shortchange those. Women have so many opportunities that were legally or socially closed off to them 100 years ago. I find it very hard as a contemporary woman, and particularly hard when teaching younger people, for them to envision powerlessness. What it was like to have so few legal rights, no rights to property, to custody of children, to physical bodies, to the right to sue, to appear in court, to get a divorce, to own property, to keep your wages. The list is so long. And it doesn't begin to change. Those legal rights don't begin to change until the 60s and 70s. That's another element of the book, if I could divert for a moment here. This relationship between black and white women, they're always learning from each other, even when they are not cooperating. They cooperate in the abolition movement. White women fight for suffrage because that's a way of pushing their issues. Black women learn from, they're really learning from each other how to organize, how to petition, how to march, how to protest. And it was the activity of Black women from 1920 into 1960 that really regenerates the women's movement. So they're using those tools in the 60s to advance us. So to answer your original question, women have made a lot of progress, but they lack progress in lots of areas. We are still physical victims of violence. We are still not fully protected in terms of maternal and infant health. Our care is inadequate. We have the majority of jobs that women hold are the lowest paid and the least respected. And even in areas where we think we've made huge advances, women in politics, women in the vice president's office as the Speaker of the House, the largest number of women serving in any political body is at the state legislature and in school boards, really the lowest level of political representation, and it's under 30%. We are more than 50% of the population. We outnumber men as registered voters. We show up. We turn out at larger numbers than male voters. And we are nowhere close to any kind of equal representation.
Let's go back a little bit, because even after women got the vote, they didn't all turn out at the polls. Why not?
First of all, you have to keep in mind that the number of women who wanted women to get the vote, the suffragists, were a really small proportion of the population. But they finally were able to create a multicultural, multiracial, multigenerational coalition. It lasted for about 3 years, but long enough to get suffrage passed at the congressional and state levels. And then it splinters and falls apart. And all of those groups of women who wanted the vote, Black women, immigrant women, labor union women, social justice women, all had a different agenda item that they wanted to pursue. So they splinter, the leadership splinters. And then all the reasons that men said women should not vote, that they were not prepared for political life, they knew nothing, they were represented by their men, they should stay home and be mothers. White women seemed to absorb those lessons. And if their husbands disapproved, they did not vote. The voting population doubles in 1920. 26 million new women are eligible to vote, and it's the lowest turnout in a presidential election ever. And then, but men are worried about whether women are going to vote, so they pass some legislation. They try to run on women's issues. Until in 1924, women don't vote again, and they repeal the things that women want. Unlike white women in Black communities, Black women were encouraged to vote, and they said, this is like going to church. This is a civic duty. This is not taking us away from our homes. We are protecting our homes. But they faced such discrimination in the state rules about who could vote, the discriminatory laws, that they had difficulty voting.
And yet, earlier on, there had been a rift between the races when Black men were given the vote before white women and women at all.
You are exactly right. Huge fight at the end of the Civil War over the passage of the 14th and 15th Amendment. And that schism, when white women opposed the 15th Amendment, which enfranchised Black men, because it did not enfranchise Black women or white women or anybody else, created huge distrust and divides this women activist population. And it will take really 100 years, you know, it really takes until the beginning of the 1960s for these women to begin to find alliances again, because there was such distrust and such, it's not only rampant racism, inbred racism, but it's just the segregation of the country. These women who had so much in common, educated, middle class, progressive, political women, Black and white, cooperated rarely, did not socialize, rarely did. It's why Eleanor Roosevelt becomes a remarkable person for, you know, socializing. It just took a really long time to overcome the legacy of slavery.
And look at what's happened recently, considering how far, in quotation marks, we have come. Then you have a woman's constitutional right to abortion taken away. The fight goes on, Betsy.
Well, as Coretta Scott King said, democracy has to be won by every generation. You can never quit. And that's certainly the lesson of this book. We make advances, and there are pushbacks. We lose. We have to start all over again. I'm hoping that the book energizes younger generations of women, not that I'm quitting, but that you just can't quit. These rights are too precious. If I can make an outraged comment about the Dobbs decision, Justice Alito in the majority decision said that he found that abortion was not deeply rooted in American history. He's wrong, of course. Abortion is deeply rooted in the civilization of the world because there have always been women who had to deal with unwanted pregnancies. Into the middle of the 19th century, everywhere and in America, those pregnancies were dealt with by midwives. Women knew when they were pregnant, midwives knew remedies, but then the male medical institutions, the American Medical Association, medical schools, state laws, begin to remove licensing privileges from midwives, try to shut down this. It wasn't really underground. It was very public. Everybody knew about it. There were advertisements about how to restore menstrual flow, but they wanted to shut that down. The Catholic Church does not oppose abortion until the 1870s. They allowed both state laws, common law, religious laws generally allowed abortion up to 20 to 24 weeks, up until quickening, which is babies kicking. And then they begin to kick it in. And the Catholic Church's issue has a lot to do with immigration and increasing population. The Protestants follow because they don't want to be outpopulated by Catholics. It has so many political overtones. But in the same way that women have pretty much been ignored and overlooked and invisible and treated like they're infant or infirm in American history, we have been legally treated as irresponsible. And so these laws have been made that keep us from having any authority or agency, and they are wrong.
With Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House, surely you believe that women's issues have indeed come to the fore as they never had before. But how much progress has her leadership made in the years that we've seen her in such a position of leadership?
Well, women's issues have clearly been high on the agenda of the Democratic caucus. In the period of maybe 1965 to 1980, they had bipartisan support. And every woman in the Congress would have been voting for the Equal Credit Act, the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, Title IX, as would many Republican and Democratic men. The Equal Rights Amendment passed with bipartisan majorities in the Congress. It wouldn't even get, I mean, there would be no bipartisan sponsorship today. It's dead because of this divisive tribalism in our political parties. And you'd think there would be some causes around which people could cohere. Similarly, the Supreme Court has changed. During the era when we were attempting ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment and women's rights were sort of prime topic in the 70s, that's when Ruth Bader Ginsburg joins the ACLU and begins bringing those cases before the court that would give women jury duty and administration of estates and Social Security rights and military benefits. And she did it all by raising cases related to men where the benefits carried over to women, because it was a very shrewd step-by-step show that men are discriminated against and that their discrimination hurts women, and then you eliminate it all and women benefit. But I blame this on Phyllis Schlafly. The fight against the Equal Rights Amendment attracted people who were offended by the Roe decision, social conservatives, Christian conservatives, and she manages to pull them into the Republican Party,
yes,
realigning
yes.
the party. She gives them to Ronald Reagan in 1980. And from that point forward, a party that, you know, the Republican Party had the ERA and the platform before anybody else, were early sponsors. From that point forward, women's rights begin to decline, and you can see it in the Congress, you can see it in the Supreme Court decisions.
your last book on Elizabeth Cady Stanton, she really did not believe that voting rights were the equivalent to equality. How did she voice that? How did she come to recognize that there was so much more that had to be done?
Well, voting rights was the only proposal in her 1848 Declaration of Rights and Sentiments at Seneca Falls, which was not really the start of the women's rights movement, was the first formal organizational acknowledgement of it. But she had a lot of other agenda items that passed unanimously among that group of 300 people in upstate New York, relating to employment and wages and women speaking in public, women being able to join professions. So she always had a big agenda. It's interesting that you mentioned Stanton, because she's, of course, at the center of that fight in 1870, when she hoped that women's support for abolition would result in universal suffrage. Black and white, male and female, immigrants, Chinese, Native Americans. You can understand why there were only 4 votes for universal suffrage in the entire Congress. Nobody wanted all those upstarts to vote. But she said suffrage would never be enough, but suffrage would be a tool. Suffrage would help you enact the rest. And it really, I mean, it is a tool. When women vote, they make a difference. But women are diverse in many ways, not just racially, but in every other way. And so there are women on both sides of these issues.
Talk about the League of Women Voters, how that came to be, and its strategy.
Good story. So Carrie Chapman Catt is really the heroine of the suffrage movement. She represents the second generation. Stanton, Anthony, Lucy Stone are the first. Carrie Chapman Catt pretty much dominates the second generation. And Alice Paul is the young, militant third generation. And there are generational mother-daughter tensions, shall we say. So Catt organized the National American Woman Suffrage Association, which came out of a reunification of the competing branches of suffrage. And in 1915, she took it over and had this winning plan. She was going to woo Wilson. She was going to win lots of voting rights at the state so that the representatives from those states would vote for suffrage in the Congress. She had a 2-tier, very complex strategy in mind. And then they win. And so she has this organization of 2 million women in almost every legislative district in the country, even in the South. And she wants to turn it in to sort of a continue the fight. We're not done. We have things still to do. We should lobby. We should run for office. And frankly, I don't know why those women did not run for office. They all should have been in the Senate. But equally respected in that suffrage movement was Jane Addams, the woman who started the whole Settlement House movement. Equally respected, equally powerful, equally committed to women's rights. And Adams says, no, let's consider, we know we have all these women out here who are anxious about voting. Let's do voter education. Let's be good government. Let's be nonpartisan. And that position becomes the majority position. So the National American Women's Suffrage Association becomes the League of Women Voters in 1920 and takes, I mean, a significant but basically a passive role for a group that had changed the country over a 50-year period. And then, because Carrie Chapman Catt personally could not stand Alice Paul, I mean, they had not spoken to each other since April of 1917 when they co-hosted a breakfast for Jeanette Rankin, the first woman in the Congress, so that when suffrage is actually certified by the Secretary of State on August 26, 1920, Secretary of State Bainbridge Colby does not invite them to the signing because he knows, everybody in Washington knows, they don't speak to each other. So Catt hated Paul, so the League of Women Voters hated the National Women's Party. In 1923, the National Women's Party introduces the Equal Rights Amendment, and the League of Women Voters says, if Alice is in favor of it, we're against it. The League of Women Voters oppose the Equal Rights Amendment until after it passes in 1972, then decides it better get on the bandwagon and says, well, now that we're in the states and we have chapters and we're ratifying, well, we should be in charge of this fight. Alice Paul is still alive, and she says, no, you don't. It was one of the advantages Phyllis Schlafly always had, that she really was the single head of the opposition. And there were so many women's organizations clearly in favor of the Equal Rights Amendment, there were more than 100, that they all wanted a place at the table or the microphone or at the front of the march. So it was a harder coalition to manage. But the League, the League clearly played a role. Many of the early women, maybe most of the women who are members of Congress from the 20s into the 60s, a lot of those women still would not have gone to college. And they weren't really joking. They would say, I earned my degree in the League of Women Voters. And they had.
Interesting.
They had.
What about Eleanor Roosevelt? What role did she play in all this?
Well, I have a chapter in my book called The Eleanor Effect. So I think she was a pretty powerful influence on the women's movement. But in reality, she, like women for most of American history, had no actual power. She had moral authority. She had a voice. She had access to a very powerful person who mostly ignored her. But she, after Franklin's accident, when she's his eyes and ears in the Democratic Party, partly as a reason to help him recover from polio by remaining connected, she goes out on her own and is organizing women in New York State, driving around in a little blue roadster, and she loves it. She says, of course, that she's just doing this for Franklin, but she's creating a political network.
Of course.
And those women really become the social justice advocates of the Democratic Party. They're for labor reform. They end up for all kinds of civil rights, African-American rights, anti-lynching, against quotas for Jews. They're always in the forefront. And she and her cronies, Frances Perkins, Molly Dewson, Mary McLeod Bethune, whom she invites into the administration, in their own way, are pushing every button they can. So the advances that women make, which are not that many in that period because of the Depression, but you can clearly credit Eleanor. The Fair Labor Standards Act is huge, and it passes because of Eleanor, Frances Perkins, Molly Dewson, and Mary Norton, who's chairing the Labor Committee. It's really four women who get that legislation through.
So you say what really changed women's lives was the opportunity for greater employment during World War II. The Rosie the Riveter symbol stands out there for all of us. And that played such an important part in what women saw other women doing.
And seeing what they could do themselves. But, you know, the posters, the propaganda posters, the one on Life magazine, the one by Norman Rockwell, those are our white women. But one of the good things about the war was that women of all backgrounds were pulled into the war industries. It gave them a way to leave home. It gave them a way to make money. If they were married, it gave them some sense of independence. They worked for the same reasons that most people work. They needed the money, and they enjoyed the camaraderie and the sense of accomplishment and agency. And frankly, we wouldn't have won the war without all those Rosies. I love the photograph in my book of Marilyn Monroe before she's Marilyn Monroe, working in a radio airplane factory in Southern California. Of course, there are very few photographs of black Rosies in the public realm. But things that move women along: having an education, having access to get an education, having the opportunity to have a job that gives them not only personal agency, but if you're bringing income into a family, into a marriage, you have something to say about how it's spent, even if there's not very much of it. And while we all think that women, you know, happily left the assembly lines to go have many babies at the end of the war and create the baby boom in the suburbs, the statistics show that the number of women in the workforce, in the American workforce, has never declined since 1947. It is this upward line on any chart. And that's enormously important. Education and employment give women agency. When they have agency, then they care about things like equal wages, child care, what's happening in my community, how the commuter routes are. Very important for women.
And a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
We're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Elizabeth Griffith. Her new book is titled Formidable. You talk about Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Alice Paul, Phyllis Schlafly. These are all white women. Were there black women equally as prominent in moving the movement forward?
So many. From one of my favorites is Frances Ellen Walker Harper, who in 1868, in a meeting with Stanton, challenges her and says, it's a meeting of the American Equal Rights Association. And Harper says to Stanton, "You're talking about rights. I want to talk about wrongs. Here are all the humiliations that black women face. Why are you not supporting us? Why are you oppressing us?" And Stanton, arrogant woman that she was, erases those remarks from the minutes of the meeting. Harper, Ida Wells Barnett, Mary Church Terrell, Mary McLeod Bethune, Polly Murray, Constance Baker Motley, these women are much less well-known than they deserve to be, although I have to say, perhaps in the black community, they are as well-known as Stanton and Anthony are in the white community. But I want everybody to know who they are. I want to name these names. Ella Baker, Diane Nash, Daisy Bates, Septima Clark. Those four in particular are huge. And while I may have recognized two of their names, you know, a little bit, I did not know in depth how huge their contribution was.
How long did it take you to do this research? This is an enormous book filled with the people who moved this whole process forward.
Diane, I'm always worried when reviewers say this is a huge book. Somebody said it was a hefty book. I don't want people to think that it's a doorstopper.
No, it's not a doorstopper.
Because all these people are so engaging and interesting and feisty. Well, you know, you interviewed me years ago, once on Stanton, but once about women's education and women's history. I have, you know, this is my field. So I've really been thinking about these topics for a long time. But I will say it was the Women's March that really made me think I have to start writing this down. And then I'd started too late to actually have a book come out on the 2020 anniversary of suffrage. But I think in the long run, that was a huge benefit because I got to then cover to the end of the Trump administration. So while the book begins with certification of the 19th Amendment and ends with confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett, that's sort of an arc and a metaphor. But so even a person who feels pretty expert in this field had lots more to learn. As I say, I knew about some of these women, but some were brand new to me, and I'm embarrassed to admit that. Septima Clark is a woman who had been a well-educated African-American teacher in Charleston, South Carolina, and on the Gullah Islands, who was fired because she joined the NAACP in the late 1940s. So she has no job. At that time, there was an organization called the Highlander School in Grundy County, Tennessee, that had been organized in the 30s to organize white workers, how to strike, how to protest. And because it was the McCarthy era, the organizers of Highlander thought, we maybe need to expand our base here, so let's think about doing civil rights education as well. We'll have more supporters. They won't be able to get us for one thing. They were constantly being threatened and shut down. So they hire Septima Clark. She is the only black woman in Grundy County, Tennessee. She cannot go to church. She cannot cash a check. She can shop at the back doors of places. And she begins this citizenship, this idea of citizenship education, not only teaching teachers to go out as agents, sort of underground agents in church basements and working under the guise of maybe being public health nurses into Black communities to teach people how to register, how to answer the questions, how to organize enough people to vote, but she's also teaching them to read and write, American history, the Constitution, how to start a credit union, how to write a check, how to ride a bus. The state of Tennessee eventually closes down the Highlander School under the communist charge, and Martin Luther King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference hire her. And so she's behind the freedom schools of the early 1960s that culminate in Freedom Summer, that end up with the Voting Rights Act, that register huge numbers of African-American voters up to 1970. When the city of Charleston invites her to return, she's elected to the school board. Her wages are reinstated. It's just a fabulous story.
What led to the passage of the Equal Pay Act in 1963?
That is very interesting in many ways, Diane, because first of all, it's the first piece of federal legislation relating to women since suffrage in 1920. There had been no specific action on women, but things were stirring up. Things had begun to stir up. And President Kennedy, when he was running for office, was opposed by Alice Paul and her Women's Party because he was not in favor of the Equal Rights Amendment. Kennedy, as a Democrat supported by labor unions, could not support the Equal Rights Amendment because people thought in 1920, less so in 1960, but in 1920, they thought if women were treated equally, they would lose all of the protections, like having a break to go change their menstrual pads or not working as many hours or not crawling through coal shafts, things that had been very reluctantly put in place for women only, not for men. And they would lose protective labor legislation. So labor unions opposed the Equal Rights Amendment, and Democrats opposed Alice Paul because she was a Republican. So Kennedy, opposing the Equal Rights Amendment, did not have quite as warm Democratic women support as he expected, despite the attractiveness. So Esther Peterson, who became the consumer rights person, is the highest-ranking Democrat that he appoints. She's Assistant Secretary of Labor, head of the Women's Bureau of the Labor Department. She says to him, let's create a commission. We know we don't want the Equal Rights Amendment, so the best way to oppose it is to have a commission on women's rights. We'll just talk about it, and we'll make sure there's no supporter of the Equal Rights Amendment on it. We'll just, you know, fill it with antis, and we'll come up with some suggestions. So this group begins to meet in 1961 and is making sort of reports as they go along. And the wages issue is apparent. So that legislation gets stirred up. It actually passes before the commission publishes its final report. Eleanor Roosevelt Kennedy persuaded Eleanor Roosevelt to chair the commission, even though she was really mad at him for not opposing McCarthy. She did not support him in either 56 or 60, but he recognized how powerful she was. So she was the titular chair, but Esther Peterson ran it. On the Equal Rights Amendment, the report, the Status of Women Commission report, said that we don't really need an Equal Rights Amendment. We could always use the 14th Amendment, which nobody had ever used. But then the only person that they didn't realize was pro-ERA on the commission, Marguerite Raywalt, an attorney, slipped in the word now. We do not need an Equal Rights Amendment now. So they sort of slipped that one by. But within 5 years, enough things had changed, partly because of Title VII and Martha Griffiths, who's a heroine, that the Equal Rights Amendment gained a lot of momentum with the women's movement, with the civil rights movement, with the anti-war movement. It's also wonderfully interwoven. It really is this colorful tapestry.
Truly, truly. So where do you think the Equal Rights Amendment stands now?
I think it's dead. I think it died on June 30th, 1982. And I think partisans and historians know that because when it still had co-sponsors, every new session of Congress, it was reintroduced. So you would not reintroduce an action that you thought was just waiting to be ratified by three more states. 38 states who voted since 1972 is not continuous voting. It doesn't match the rules that relate to how we ratify amendments. I think you could still make a case that it's needed, but you could also make a case that the first section of the 14th Amendment does say equal protection of the law. The court has been very hesitant to use it. The actions that passed, I related earlier under that Ruth, that the ACLU and RBG brought to the court that advanced women, those mostly relied on Title VII because they might have been employment related. They, whenever they could avoid using the 14th Amendment, the court did. But it's dead because there's no bipartisan support to introduce it. The state legislatures, more than a majority, are controlled by Republicans. And there's such division in this country on even defining women's rights.
And Title VII does exactly what?
It forbids discrimination against women on account of sex in any employment-related, and that's been extended to other areas of American life. What's very interesting is Justice Gorsuch, it's a gay rights case. It was the summer of 2020, about a gay man being fired for playing on a gay baseball team, and his employer fired him. And Gorsuch ruled that under Title VII, sex included LGBTQ. But one of the issues about the Equal Rights Amendment were one to reintroduce it, or, well, first, if one were to attempt to ratify the one that's dead or to reintroduce it, people should look closely at the language, because it's equality of rights shall not be denied by the United States or any state on account of sex. So how are we defining sex? You know, sex used to be body parts. Now body parts can be changed. Now sex is identity. Whose sex, what sex are we defining? And that's such a hot topic that nobody's going to want to address that. And there are many state legislatures in the country who would never want to vote on that at the moment. So it's a messy topic. But but just think of it. We are now, next year will be 100 years since the Equal Rights Amendment was introduced. Alice Paul went back to Seneca Falls, had pageants on the shores of the lake to introduce it. And in 100 years, we still do not have, for certain, a guarantee that people actually use to protect women's equal rights in the Constitution.
How much do you believe the presidency of Donald J. Trump affected women's rights?
I think the presidency of Donald Trump has done severe damage to women's rights, but worse damage in the destruction of our democracy, in the disrespect for law, in increasing tribal hatreds and division. He did not understand the role of the presidency, what has been the traditional role of the presidency. He seems to have no respect for the Constitution. I know that's clearly a partisan statement, but I grew up as a Midwestern Republican, and I despair that there are so few Republicans who honor those policies, those traditions, those positions, who would cross an aisle to vote for a veterans bill. Serving in government is an honorable role. I do not disrespect it. I wish more people did it. Clearly more women should be doing it. But it needs to be done by people who understand what the job is. It's to solve problems for the citizens of our country. It's to find compromise. It's to move us ahead step by step. You know, both Republicans and Democrats have said that the perfect is the enemy of just a little progress. Let's pass part of a bill, and then the next part, let's move it along. And I think concerns me most deeply today is the lack of empathy. People who do not understand the lives of other Americans. I wish that I better understood the lives of Trump voters and why they feel as they do. And I wish they understood the lives of women who are desperately making choices about their families, their bodies, and their lives, and so many other issues.
So, where do you see the women's movement today and moving forward.
In the hands of young people, when I first marched, my first march was maybe 1972 in Washington down Constitution Avenue with my husband wearing white. I was so full of optimism that we'd seen what the civil rights marches had done, what the anti-war marches had done, women's marches were having an impact. I was filled with optimism that citizens could impact the decisions of politicians who voted. And I think marching has some, I think it shows passion, and I think it shows commitment and numbers of people who care about something. But we have got to go back into the trenches. We have to be Carrie Chapman Catt, legislative district by legislative district. We need to lobby. We need to elect people. Suffrage, Susan B. Anthony called the long, hard fight. And then in 1920, people were so excited. Now we can begin. I think we're back to the long, hard fight. And we've got to start and be vigilant and not take it for granted. And I'm the only good thing that maybe comes out of the Dobbs decision is that young women are going to get that they are not protected, that they have been really undermined by the current court, and they're going to have to find a way to fight back for those rights. We're going to need an underground railroad to protect women who need to travel. So many things need to be done, and women are going to have to step up and do it.
Betsy, thank you so much for this conversation.
Diane, it's always a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
That was Elizabeth Griffith. Her new book is Formidable, American Women and the Fight for Equality, 1920 to 2020. And that's all for today. We welcome your feedback and suggestions. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Kellen Quigley. Thanks for listening, all. See you next week. I'm Diane Reams.